What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
Temporary Protected Status, or TPS, was created by Congress as part of the Immigration Act of 1990. It allowed the executive branch, particularly the Secretary of Homeland Security, to declare that it is unsafe for, I hate this word, but it's the word I got, foreigners to return to their home, to their home countries in light of extraordinary temporary conditions, such as armed conflict, natural disasters, or other internal crises. Haiti was first designated for the TPS program in 2010 under the Obama administration when the devastating 7.0 magnitude earthquake hit the island. Syria received its TPS designation in 2012, shortly after a civil war began. In the years that followed, those designations were extended following federal review. In a 6-3 ruling, TPS for Haitians and Syrians has ended effectively at the bidding of the Trump administration. Joining us to discuss is Nana Gyamfi, Executive Director of the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, Arbaji. Good morning.
Greetings. Very good to be here with you, per usual.
It's always good to see your face. I wish it was about other things. All my favorite people, all we talk about is sad stuff or angering stuff.
Yeah, that's true.
All of them, like, right on. All right, this is our lives. Nana, I mentioned that Haitians were first granted TPS following the earthquake. And for folks who don't remember that earthquake, devastating, horrific, tens of thousands of people in camps, homes destroyed, no resources to rebuild, plus the ongoing violence from the DR. I mean, it was just a really horrific time. The TPS status was reviewed and approved many times over since that point. What were reasons for ongoing approval?
So in the beginning, the ongoing approval was because the conditions had not changed. In other words, after that devastating earthquake, given the level of infrastructure issues that already existed, of course, it wasn't like a jump right back. And I often describe or try to compare this with folks to what we saw after Hurricane Katrina, right? Hurricane Katrina happens. All these folks have to leave. Some come to California. Some go to Texas. A year and a half later, in some cases, years later, people still didn't have their houses. The devastation still existed. And this is in the United States of America. Think about a place like Haiti, so exploited, so extracted from by countries such as the United States, Canada, France, so much political instability caused by the United States, Canada, and France to make it difficult for that kind of recovery to happen. So in the beginning was for those reasons. And then you had the assassination of the president of Haiti, again, with Western powers, including the United States, very much thought to be a part of how that assassination happened. We've recently had convictions that happened in the United States courtroom, which, that's very weird. I don't know why the United States was having those hearings at that trial. But the best way to cover up yourself is to do things in your own house. But that became another reason, the assassination of the president, to have TPS. And then we have the increased violence that is happening on the ground. And just as in our neighborhoods, these guns, these weapons are not being made and, developed in people's basements. These are being dropped off. These are being sold. These are being brought in by powers that are outside of Haiti. And the violence there is such to the point that the United States and other countries are telling their people not to go to Haiti. And the only people from the U.S. that are ending up in Haiti right now, for the most part, are people being deported by this country.
Listen, let me help put some oomph on what Nana just said. It is, the conditions are so violent in Haiti right now that some of the tribes, that's what street tribes is what we call them here. Gangs is what some folks call.
Right.
We're shooting planes down as they tried to come into Haiti. Like that, they have control of the ports. There is ongoing sexual assault. There was widespread food shortage, water shortage. So Basically, the way that I've heard folks that are paying attention to this issue is this is a death sentence.
Yeah, it's a death sentence for so many people. I mean, let's include in here, Kat, the kidnappings that are happening of people. And some of these kidnappings happening by the police who are kidnapping people, taking them into jail, going on Facebook, you know, seeing if they can find people's family members and then contacting them and saying, hey, we've got your person. You need to come up with tens of thousands of dollars, US dollars, if you want to ever see this person alive again. This is what's already been happening. And many of those people being people who have been deported. So as soon as they hit that airport, they're getting swooped up by folks, getting kidnapped, and that drama is occurring. That situation hasn't changed. And in order for TPS to be terminated, it would have to be found, not just, you know, put your finger in the wind, not based upon people's whims, but actually found on facts that the conditions that caused a need for protective status have changed. And that obviously has not happened. And I think it's an important point because when people hear temporary, what is being spun is that temporary has a distinct timeline. No, what has the timeline is the review. So you get temporary status for 18 months. When they get closer to that 18 months, we look to see, hey, what are the conditions? If the conditions continue, then the status is supposed to continue. If Haiti was, you know, now into a situation where all was good, it would be a different, you know, we'd be talking about something different. That is clearly not what the condition is. And truthfully, Kat, you and I both know that Haitians should have asylum status. If we could be united for Ukraine and have a process for Ukrainians to get a permanent immigration status, I am confused, but not really, about why for Haiti we do not have help for Haiti, you know, whatever cute little term they have to come up with that allows Haitians to have an asylum program, given that their condition is much more dire over the long term, and given the role the United States has played and continues to play in creating those conditions.
Well, that's what I was about to say. Let's go one step further. Haitians should actually be bathing, rolling in gold-paved streets in their own resources. But unfortunately, right, because it is a resource-rich country, that's not the problem. The problem is United States, Canada, and France. Those are the problems. There are lots of groups that Trump can and has targeted. Why this focus right now on Haitians and Syrians?
So this is not new, right? Because remember, the reason this is happening at this time, or part of the reason, is because court cases were filed. The terminations actually were made, or the decision to determine was made a year ago, right? It's the pushing by people and saying no, both in the streets and in the courts, to say no, we're not going to stand for this, that brings us now into this moment. But his targeting of Haitians and Syrians is particular. You know, I'm going to focus on Haitians, not because I don't think the 6,000 Syrians on TPS also are important and that they also don't need TPS. We understand that Islamophobia is also one of the things that this regime is full of and perpetuates, from war to the rejection of refugees and the ending of temporary protective status for folks who are considered to be, you know, generally Muslim, even though we know that there's other people of other faiths in these countries. But, you know, this regime is very caricature creating. So it's not that I don't care about that, but we're talking about 350,000 Haitians that have been here in some cases for, you know, 15 years and have built here, have buried people here, have, you know, built families here, have become part of the fabric of communities over this long period of time. And he has a thing for Haitians. The United States has a thing for Haitians. It was the Biden administration that was whooping Haitians in Del Rio, right? So let's not get it twisted. It's not just a Trump thing. Haitians were the first to be locked up in the mass incarceration of the immigration enforcement system in the 90s. You and I remember this, Kat. with Guantanamo Bay and on these just open air prisons in Florida. So there's a thing with Haiti as a country that is unequivocally Black, the country that threw off the chains of enslavement in a revolution that beat back the white empire. And so there's always an extra crispiness about the anti-Blackness that the United States shows to Haiti. And this regime insists, as part of its authoritarian, fascist, you know, white supremacist dreams, to bring forth the worst of whatever anti-Blackness has existed in this country. And so, of course, the attacks on Haiti are, you know, and on Haitians are to be expected under those circumstances.
Nana, you mentioned that, like, we're here at this point now after hard-fought legal battles that were lost in the Supreme Court. What pathways in the criminal legal system or legal system are remain here?
So what's going to have to happen, you know, on the legal side in terms of this particular attack? And I think it's important to point out that there's two attacks that were made on this termination, two things that were raised by Haitian TPS holders. One was respect to the conditions, to say, hey, you actually didn't look at the conditions. You didn't follow the process. You just move forward. But the second, equally important, that I want to make sure we mention is that the TPS holders were saying this is based on race. Now, there's a whole list of ways that this president and this regime has made clear that they actually are doing this in a form of anti-Blackness, and went on to list up, they're eating cats and dogs, they all have HIV, like all of the things, you know, S-hole countries, all the things that this president has said specifically about Haiti or about Black countries. And that was also rejected by the Supreme Court majority, with the Alito saying, hey, you know, people talk like that. It's no big deal. Nothing to see here. That's not actually racism. Just because you wear blackface and talk about fried chicken and watermelon, what are you saying? If you don't actually say, I hate Black people, it doesn't count. I mean, that's basically what the the man was saying. And so when we look at the end, that he also said that you can, that the president has the right to end TPS without judicial review. Very important. Without judicial review. So giving another civil impunity, right, to this president. So when we look at what can happen further in the court piece, not too much, right? It's going to go back to the lower court, the lower courts that where this case is originated, where the TPS holders filed their cases. What can the lower courts do? They're going to have to do whatever the Supreme Court said, which is to allow the president to terminate. There's no, you know, you can take it to the shrine, but there's no court above the Supreme Court on that level. However, there are some things we can do legislatively. So there's a Senate bill that's going forth right now, a Senate resolution that we're asking folks to call their senator. You can reach out to policy@bajie.org. We will give you a script. We'll give you other information so that you can make that happen. Again, that's policy@bajie.org. Please do so. We'll share more information about some permanent solutions we're making to this issue, because begging for support every 18 months for temporary support, that's for the birds. We got to do something different. Very good to be here with you, per usual.
We are going to move on to the water crisis happening right now in Puerto Rico. And I think it'd actually be, adequate. Okay, to say that that the ongoing water crisis in Puerto Rico, because this is actually not new. It is 8:24 in the morning here on Law and Disorder. I am your host, Kate Brooks. Thousands of Puerto Ricans are without water, and it is severe enough. The governor thought fit to call in the National Guard to help distribute what little water there is to go around. I'm always surprised when we use military apparatus to do mutual aid, but that's a different segment probably. Joining us to discuss is Deborah Santana, retired professor of geography and ethnic studies at Mills College, and author of Kicking Off the Bootstraps, Organizing from Las Piedras, Puerto Rico. She drives global solidarity movements for Cuba, Palestine, and Venezuela. She's a lifelong anti-imperialist, a leader in the Puerto Rican Independence Party, and a frontline activist who fought to stop the U.S. Navy bombing of Vieques. Good morning.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you here. I think I actually do want to start just with material conditions on the ground in Puerto Rico right now. What is the impact on people? How are people surviving?
Well, you know, this water crisis, which actually didn't start just now, but of course it's been aggravated by a lot of circumstances, is part of the general crisis that I would say is part of the three C's: colonialism, capitalism, and corruption. It's been cooking for quite some time. And besides the fact that we have ongoing electricity crisis, primarily because of the privatization of this essential service and a partial privatization of the water service, this is a kind of ongoing crisis of non-sustainability. Colonialism is not sustainable. Capitalism is not sustainable. And Puerto Rico is sort of in the FAFO. We're in the FO part of FAFO, where everything is kind of coming together, where very little is working.
That might be one of the favorite things that a guest has ever said on this show. Oh, right on. We're at the find out. For folks who don't know, it's a bleep around and find out. And this is the find out moment. So that actually segues, because I almost started here, but I wanted to talk about material conditions, because as I'm thinking about a population where 40% of folks are under the poverty line. I'm thinking about disabled folks. I'm thinking about elderly folks. I'm thinking about the fact that this is colliding with summer. I'm thinking about how is this going to impact the electoral cold grid. I'm thinking of people that need have caretakers, right, and caregivers that are now also in crisis. So the ripple effect, the material impact on actual people in this find out moment is serious. Is something we need to pay attention to, and could actually get worse. Yes,
absolutely, absolutely. Puerto Rico, as a colony without sovereignty, and we don't vote in U.S. elections, we vote in our own colonial elections, such as they are. But it was also a aging population. Many of our youngest people have left. Fewer now, because going to the United States is not the attraction it may once have been, for obvious reasons. But they have a serious problem. There are fewer of them. And there are many of us. I guess one of the aging population segment. And the issue of the crisis of the privatization and capitalization of healthcare, the privatization of electric services, of water services, the lack of control of real estate and the development for tourism, for luxury tourism, and the basically open season for North Americans who get tax breaks to buy up a lot of our properties and price us out. Plus the years of building where we're not supposed to build in the coastal areas, the mangrove areas, deforesting the basins, the river basins. And I just want to mention that Puerto Rico, of the greater Antilles, the four larger islands of the Caribbean, we're the ones with the most water. And that's not necessarily helping us because of the legacy of all these years of building according to a model that might be better for the United States. And in fact, it's not so good for the United States either. But this kind of like continental model in a small tropical island. And so all of this is kind of coming to a head at the same time. When you add to this that right now in climate with climate change, which is real, we're now in a hurricane season, but we're also in what's going to be probably one of the largest El Nino season since it's recorded, which of course means there's going to be more hurricane activity in the Pacific, but less here in the Atlantic. And one hurricane that hits you directly is catastrophic, but none of us really are sad to not see a lot of hurricanes. But that also means that those processes, global processes, are what bring us our rainfall, which we need in the rainy season. And it's also causing an increase in what we call the Sahara dust, the polvo de Sahara, which also is the same system, basically, literally Sahara dust coming to the Caribbean, which has its ecological function, but also inhibits the formation of tropical waves. So this is shaping up to a drier than normal season, which when you add to the legacy of poor planning or sometimes no planning and maintenance, little maintenance of our water system because it's been parceled out to political allies who cut corners. A lot of those systems are failing right now due to the lack of maintenance. So it's all kind of together at the same time.
Can you talk about, I was trying to figure out where I wanted to go next after that. You sort of answered all of my questions in one brilliant response. So I may ask you to repeat some threads to parse some stuff out some more. But first, I want to go to House Bill 1079 by Jenny Mendez, which is Puerto Rico's Speaker of the House of Representatives, which would weaken, as I understand from me, protections on the island's karst region, which covers 27.5% of Puerto Rico and has all sorts of resources, limestone, underground water sources, caves, et cetera. This would be yet another attack on natural systems, yes,
for extraction. Yes, and it's part of a package of different bills, which I'll mention. But just to speak about that, the karst region, and in fact, someone who studied geology, if the people who named karst regions had been to Puerto Rico before they went to Eastern Europe, which is where it's named for, they probably would have named it for us because it's a perfect example of an area that has to do with, you know, the calcite rocks and other geological formations, which causes a storage and production of fresh water and an incredible underground system of rivers. We have actually the second largest underground river system in the Western Hemisphere. The first, I believe, not far from the Grand Canyon, but we're the second. All right, so to give you an idea, and that literally is responsible for the fact that we have so much good fresh water in great segments of Puerto Rico, the entire north. Parts of the west, parts of the central, and of course, for people who are not familiar with Puerto Rico, we're very mountainous, but the mountain is mostly east to west and along the central, and the northern part is more humid, the Atlantic part, and the southern part, which is the Caribbean part, is drier, okay, just to give people an idea. The karst region has long been protected by a series of legal measures. It precisely to try to slow down and to protect the destruction of the karst region. There have been damages to the karst region, but that is an incredibly important element of what makes Puerto Rico livable. But like I said, there are a couple of other proposed laws that go together. One of them has to do with changing how the maritime zone, the zona maritima, is defined, because the maritime zone also protects and limits how much you can develop those areas. Those are the areas with coastal dunes, the areas with mangroves, the areas that are wetlands, the areas that really need to be protected. They're part of our protection against hurricanes. They are part of our protection of species, fish, for example, vegetation. And there are also areas that if you do a lot of building, they are extremely vulnerable. If you have an earthquake, for example, you know, a lot of the really bad damages happens on these luxury buildings that were built on soil that should never have had those big buildings built. So just to give an example, just to name a couple of things. And then the third piece of legislation is what they call a flexibilization, I'm sure you heard this, of permits, of bureaucracy about public hearings and permits and all of that. You put all of them together, and it basically means that anything goes. The few protections that we've had that allow to get information when there's a proposal that we have doubts about, that allows us to sue, that allows us to demand hearings, that allows us to protest. All of this can be wiped away, and it can lead, and we believe it is designed to get rid of the obstacles to certain mega projects which are being proposed. So just to mention one, is a mega project which is still being proposed called Essentia. In southwestern tip of Puerto Rico and Cabo Rojo, the driest area of Puerto Rico, an area that's also very, very vulnerable as far as endangered species, and it's also seismically vulnerable, okay? And it has very little water. For the people who are there, it has very little water already. This is a mega project which includes two golf courses, if you can imagine.
I can, sadly.
Yes. And the thing is, I mentioned Essentia, not that it's the only one, but it's one of the projects that we have really managed to organize very, very well, to the point where a lot of the public has been informed about what is going on. And we actually had a protest in San Juan, a march in late March, that had over 50,000 people, and that may not sound like a lot, but in terms of our public, our present capacity, keeping in mind that we have fewer young people, a lot of older people, it was an amazing turnout when you consider that, and it also led to legislative hearings, which are still ongoing after the summer break, public hearings about the viability of this project. And that particular legislation was submitted by the Puerto Rican Independence Party over a year and a half ago, and it just sat there. Not surprising, the week after this big protest, they called for hearings. So it just gives you an idea of the legislation. You need public pressure. And just to give you an example of one thing, but yeah.
Thank you. And you actually went where I was going to go next, because the tagline of this show is expose, agitate, and build. And so I did want you to talk about the resistance that's happening. Before I let you go, so I visit Hawaii a lot. I go every 3 months. That's where I go. And I was there during the last round of storms that were pretty intense and severe, and there was extensive damage, and indigenous folks were asking people not to come, right? Like, unless send aid if you're here, help, but otherwise, like, don't come disaster tour what has happened to our communities. And what I saw online and in response was a bunch of Howleys really upset about their vacations being ruined. And I bring that up because as I was getting ready to talk to you, and I'm like sort of going down rabbit hole threads, I don't know what the equivalent term in Puerto Rico for Howleys is, but them folks really
gringos.
It's a bunch of gringos really upset about is there a vacation in Puerto Rico going to be ruined. And so the message for the gringos in this moment, please.
Yes, I would say that that's well taken, and it's not that we want to discourage tourism, but we do have to say if we have a water shortage and we have to do rationing, it's absolutely not fair that the hotels get water and the people don't, and especially the Airbnbs. And I have to specifically say they do not pay the taxes that the hotels do, which at least help somewhat. They do not have the regulations. It is not regulated here. And I'll just give you an example. And there's a part of San Juan called Condado and Ocean Park that has really been plagued by these Airbnbs, and a lot of these have been connected. They are many of them the product of a real estate speculation by people who don't even live here, who buy up the rental housing so our own working people cannot buy there. And then they are simply connecting their services without having approved connections to the sewers. And so it is not uncommon on the beach at Isla Verde and the beach right over there to have brown currents coming out onto the beach. It sounds disgusting. It is disgusting. And a lot of it has to do with the not following of permits and with just a proliferation of these Airbnbs. I beg of the people who are going to come here on vacation, please go to a hotel, go to a bed and breakfast, one that is actually certified. You'll have a good time. And if you don't have water, there's a reason why you don't have water. So you roll with it. And if you can't roll with it, find someplace else to go. And please don't bother the Hawaiians. Please don't bother our friends there.
Right. So many correlations. All right, Deborah, I've got to let you go. Thank you so much for coming on, sending care to you all there, and likely talk to you again soon.
My pleasure. And viva Puerto Rico Libre.
We've been speaking to Deborah Santana, retired professor of geography and ethnic studies at Mills College and author of Kicking Off the Bootstraps, Organizing from Las Piedras, Puerto Rico. She drives global solidarity movements for Cuba, Palestine, and Venezuela.
Listen, so understand the complexity. Two homes, two worlds, two notions of identity. Where money motivates bigotry and 12 kills every 28 flippantly. I try to dream of roses with no concrete. Kofi Annan and I cheek philosophies. Lows with high cheekbone anomalies. Yami Yai is a high priest. Sun kiss so we forget where the bottom be. But everybody ain't a Huckabee. On the block you can cop a piece before your teens. It's hard to make it straight when guided by the crooked streets. With loving words only make it to the eulogy. So we grind just to make it to the master seat. But the reason Levine's on the master end. Cause you make it to the house selling field man.
You're at Montessori. I am your host, Kat Brooks. Verdicts in the Golden Gate 26 case have come in. The Golden Gate 26 are a group of protesters who shut down the Golden Gate Bridge on tax day in 2024 to bring attention to the fact that U.S. tax dollars were being utilized for genocide. D.A. Brooke Jenkins has spent the last 2 years trying to throw the book at them. We know that D.A. Brooke Jenkins has spoken out in support of Israel. Historically, about 7 protesters. We're looking at felonies that could have carried upwards of 15 years or more, I think, in prison. Joining us to discuss is Manon Kocher. If I said your name wrong, please correct me. Press correspondent and co-defendant of the Golden Gate 26. Good morning. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Kat. Thank you for having me.
So 7 demonstrators were found guilty on misdemeanor charges. The judge declared a mistrial on the felony conspiracy charge and a misdemeanor trespass to interfere with the business charge because jurors were unable to reach a verdict. Brooke Jenkins is just celebrating all of this and saying, you know, that they were convicted on multiple counts. And she says that all 7 could still face a retrial on 2 unresolved charges, something that I hear surprised the team. And then lastly, I'm getting through some of this because I know we have limited time. The sentencing is still to happen, right? Mm-hmm. So there's still, people still may be going to jail, albeit I think what I understand is county jail, not prison. Put all of what I just said in your own words as someone who also was a defendant, and then mm-hmm. concerns, yes, about what precedent is this setting for taking direct action against injustice? If this could happen in San Francisco, which I know is not the San Francisco of before, mm-hmm. what is the signal for the rest of the country, especially when we got a fascist in the White House? Well, we got to put our bodies on the line, right? We don't have a choice now.
Yeah. Thanks, Kat, for that overview and summary of the case. So my my own case, I faced 44 charges, misdemeanor counts, for over 2 years. And my case was resolved via the process of diversion on June 15th of this year. Seven of my fellow co-defendants had to go through the process of trial over the course of 2 months, only to learn a verdict where they were found guilty of multiple misdemeanor counts, including 4 counts of false imprisonment. Now, that is where the precedent that you were speaking of, that is scary for the movement, that is scary for folks that stand up against fascism, against injustices, really comes in. Being guilty of false imprisonment implies that in the future, if we use tactics of blocking roadways, which has been a tool of the people to draw attention to the emergencies of our times, the government can charge you with false imprisonment of commuters behind you. They can come forward and go onto social media like SFDA Jenkins did 2 years ago and solicit people to come forward as apparent victims of protesters who are asking our government to stop our tax dollars being used to kill children and people across the world. So the precedent set here is extremely dangerous, and the fight is far from over. The fight in this case is far from over, as I hope we appeal these convictions. The fight is far from over as DA Jenkins threatens to retry the case on the felony counts. And the fight is far from over from the United States funding and arming this genocide.
What do we do now? In the immediacy.
So the call to action is to support efforts to stop arms transfers to Israel immediately. A local and one that is connected with a lot of different efforts across the country is joining the Oakland Arms Embargo Campaign on armsembargonow.com. The sentencing hearing is coming up on August the 21st. We ask folks to please support us and follow us on GG26 Solidarity on Instagram and follow updates on the case on GoldenGateDefendants.com. Those are some immediate ways in which folks can be supportive of us. But the fight is far from over, Kat. And even though we welcome the fact that the jury didn't convict our co-defendants on the felony conspiracy charge, speaking to some of their conscience, we are sitting in some grief given the recent convictions.
Why do I know it's those last questions? I think I'm just gonna shorten my announcements this morning. What does Brooke Jenkins get out of persecuting people that stood against genocide?
So Brooke Jenkins, the charging of Brooke Jenkins' office has increased by 60% since 2021. So the prosecution in this case is not isolated, Kat, as you know. The prosecution across San Francisco has been going up, and people in power don't want ordinary people to disrupt their day-to-day lives as they build arms, as they ship them, as they send our money to Israel. Maintaining the hegemonic power of the U.S.-Israeli alliance is very much one of the things that is really important to people in power, especially in the Bay Area. So Brooke Jenkins and her office is a tool to prosecute anyone who speaks out against that. She is doing that job. However, one last thing that I would say is that we were charged with 1,144 counts in August of 2024. At the start of this trial, the DA's office was tasked to prove that only 57 of those charges, so the charges dwindled from 1,000 over 1,100 to 57 charges. And she was tasked to prove without a reasonable doubt that those 57 charges, that my fellow protesters were guilty of those 57 charges. She was not able to do that. So the case continues to dwindle and it continues to unfold at great cost to my co-defendants and at a great cost to our community and the people of Palestine, Lebanon, and Syria who are continuing to face this genocide. So we are steadfast in this fight, and I appreciate you bringing us on here to share this story.
Anytime. If we don't reach out to y'all, y'all hit us up when it's time for y'all to come back. You will always have a platform.
We will. Thank you so much for joining this morning.
Yes. Take care. Coacher is a press correspondent and co-defendant of the Golden Gate 26 who stopped traffic on the Golden Gate Bridge on tax day 2024. None of the seven other lawyers are able to speak out at this time.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.